You are listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at cvillepodcast.com for radio shows, lectures, original programming, and more. On October 1st, 2008, Lisa Williams read for an audience at the New Dominion Bookshop in downtown Charlottesville from her award-winning collection of poetry, Woman Reading to the Sea.
So nice to see so many friendly faces and people I haven't seen in so long. I'm going to read 9 or 10 poems. And I wanted to thank David and New Dominion for hosting this reading. So the book is called Woman Reading to the Sea, and the cover is a painting by a friend of mine that I met when I was living at the American Academy in Rome, Franco Mondini Ruiz. Some of you know have met him. Anyway, he's a painter and a sculptor, and the painting is quite beautiful, I think. It's of a woman standing on the shore facing the ocean, and she has her back to the viewer, and she has a book open and is reading, apparently, aloud to the sea. And so I was very inspired by some of Franco's paintings, this one in particular. I actually helped him come up with a title for the painting. He did it while I was there in Rome. So I'm going to read this first, the title poem. Woman Reading to the Sea. There's a certain freedom in the long blue slant of its uncaring, in the wind that knocks the surface onto rocks. And there's a dent made in that wind by the woman who recites straight into it, pretending the waves might hear, or that some larger being, that is sea or seeing, hangs there listening, when sea airs so clearly full of its own gusts and grunts, inanimate uprisings. In the line of no one's sight, her voice lost in the spray, she feels a chilling freedom. How the foam edges the sheets of zigzag patterned water, while gulls' shrill outbursts punctuate the sky, one cloudy, sentimental phrase or canvas brushed with amber, green, and rose. What welcomes and ignores and doesn't question? Sheer emptiness. It's like a husk for her alone. It's like a shell for absence. Without an audience, she makes a noise swallowed by waves and wind, just as the waves themselves, or no, just like the drops lost in the waves, which neither care nor keep distinctions. Sweep out a place inside an amphitheater she imagines rising around her, with columns that crash instantly, like the white foam that collides and shreds its layered castles. Her words drift, dissolve, and disappear. A crest of words has surged and poured into the sea. It doesn't matter now what the lines say. I wrote that poem while I was living in Rome for a year. David mentioned the Rome Prize, and what that meant was that I was able to live, as I said, there for about 11 months. And I wrote a number of the poems in the book while I was there. And that poem in particular, I was concerned, or thinking about what it meant not to have an audience for your work and having difficulty publishing work and also getting the manuscript taken. My first book was published in 1998. This is coming 10 years later, so it was a long process. But what I was going to say is that the ocean is a continuing image and an important theme throughout the book. I'm going to read another poem that touches on the ocean from this first section. I lived for a time in California when I was growing up. I grew up in both Nashville and California, and most recently, over the last 5 or 6 years, I've been writing poems about adolescence, which is a subject that really interests me. And so this is one of those poems that made it into the book. This is called Intoxication at Carmel by the Sea. Has anybody ever been to Carmel? Intoxication at Carmel by the Sea. There was a wish to alter consciousness. Of course, there always was. We poured half orange juice, half beef eater in two glasses, pinched our noses and quickly gulped it down. The mixture in our throats and bellies burned, then shifted to a silvery, smooth glow that radiated through our hands and faces. That was the sweet part, but the rest was sour. For years I couldn't stand the smell of gin. Experience was our experiment. We snuck out my low window to meet boys and loll around the unlit, empty town, down to the sea, if we had time to spare. Its slosh of blue, its steady, vagrant hum, mirrored our own inexact momentums. At 13 years, my grades were plummeting, but life had opened up to people, air, and landscapes tugging me from home like tides. The gin thing didn't last. Intoxications one after another were identified, tested, and tossed. What moves me from this distance is how we fell so hard for everything that drew us in, the pure, straight sentiments driving our actions, even to stupid risks. We were unused to being tentative, the careful step. Yes, I remember most that spirit of our trying, which is lost. I designed, designed isn't quite the right word, I structured the book. I've been obsessed with Milton's Paradise Lost for a very long time. It sort of guided some of the poems in my first book and was part of my thinking when I was writing poems for this book and also when I was structuring this volume. And so there are various ways in which that affected the book thematically, imagistically, and also in terms of structuring it as a sort of analogy to a fall of a certain kind, from kind of more elevated notions of purity and divinity and aesthetic beauty and artistic perfection and so on, and a kind of descent from that into through the literal cosmos and down onto the earth, and then through some poems that have to do with the planet, the evolution of the planet, also getting into the oceans and marine life and so on. So I'm going to say a little bit more about that in just a minute, but I wanted to read one of the poems that serves as a kind of bridge between the first and second section of the book. And this comes from it is inspired by Milton's Paradise Lost, specifically by Lucifer, the fictional fallen angel, who is part of the heavenly chorus. And I imagine him as being part of this heavenly chorus where, you know, there's a lot of singing going on and praises going on, but there's a desire to raise one's voice and to sing in a sort of different way. And so that's what this poem is about. Horizontally, I moved. I let my raw voice rise, but I was chastised, asked to hold my tongue. I couldn't see the scenery for wings. What good is blocked out paradise? And hour after hour to hear that pallid music, dull, facetious words repeated to the same sweet harmonies, like the manna that rained constantly to feed us. I was bored. I tore a feather from one wing and laid it on his throne, blood tipping the quill. God found the trifle and spent light rifling feathers to detect a spot of loss. So I confessed. I'd pulled it out for no good reason except my discontent. He threw me violently into chaos, racked with soot, my lush wings locked. Now I could only lower myself slowly and sink until I glimpsed reflected rays in one thin strand of river through the garden. This seemed a lasting shape, so I chose that for my seduction's body, sinuous bolts with skin like waves of water. Horizontally, I moved. Among many of the themes, the ideas of what's sacred and what's profane run throughout the volume. And as I'm moving into the second section, I'm going to read a cluster of poems from that. I wanted to mention again the work that I did for and with William McDonough and Michael Brongart, working for their design consulting firm, McDonough Brongart Design Chemistry, known as MBDC. And this work started in about 1996. And one of my major projects for that was the book Cradle to Cradle. And I don't know how many of you have worked with Bill. Has anybody other than... it's Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things. And it's the vision that the two men had, William McDonough and Michael Brongard, was industry that's modeled on the creative processes of nature. So I'm going to try to make this as short a story as I can. In the course of working on this book with them and doing research and working on the editing for this book project, I became really fascinated by their ideas, their interest in the creative processes of nature, and also discovered a lot about the world that I hadn't really thought about or looked at closely before, and this really sparked my imagination. So I was coming up with poems in response to these things and thinking of them really as environmental, though they're not directly or overtly so, but they really attempt, I think, to reestablish or kind of make more, re-enliven the connection that the individual self has to the natural world and its creative processes. And so one of the first poems in this sequence is about the sun. I'm going to read that one. It was quoted from in the article in the Hook that some of you may have seen. Farthest flame. Whatever you are comes from the sun. It is useful to remember this as you go around chasing days. The sun is not round. It appears so because its geometries are burning. It cannot have a fixed shape because its edges are locked by flame, clipped, cut, carved in a moving margin, peaked with fluid fire. Fire that is no color. Fire of such wild royal, it kills the idea of color. Fire, the idea of which is only a beginning to your mind and its elliptical frames. This fire is your reason for being, the reason itself, and in it nothing rests, nothing lives or breathes for millions and millions of miles. The sun has many tongues. It flicks coarsely. It flicks loudly. Its eruptions are violent. Of violence its own change claims. It can swallow its own disturbances on a blistered surface curling to the core, yet send out signals through the cold of space ending gently many millions of miles away. It has a light touch, this fevered origin, after, long after it leaves the place, repetitive, terrible, where dark is eaten again and again by panicked tongues, where the fire and its tongues eat darkness. I was trying to get across the sense of the dynamic, generative power of the sun. And one of the things I discovered in looking at images of it and thinking about it, working on the section on solar energy and some of the material on solar energy for McDonough and Brongard, was that the sun has many different sorts of flames on the surface, and that there are different names for all these kinds of flames, and that was really fascinating to me. And so I was trying to convey that in the poem. I'm going to, as I said, it kind of moves, attempting to be analogous to that fall that I described. The poems in the book move through the cosmos, down to the planet itself and into the oceans. I continue to write about the oceans and marine creatures and, you know, objects, planets, and so on. So those things are not limited to the book itself, but the book is really focused on that. This one's called Jellyfish, and most of the images of the Medusa jellyfish, I think that's what this one was based on. So the U is the jellyfish. I wanted to mention that the way the jellyfish moves, those of you probably know this already, that is sort of propulsive, that is pushing the water out and sort of closing up the head, which I refer to as this sort of bell-like head that pushes that water out and pushes where the creature was before, moving forward from that place. Jellyfish. Movement means closure, a thrust from where you are, that gelid other plane. Your bell-like head with wordless aperture, emptying, emptying. The pleats of your innards a shallow accordion. Your tendrils trail neon-lit cities of cells. You, pellucid fairy, invisibly carried a spun dome like the ghost of some merry-go-round. And we who don't float with such unconscious ease think it terror to rise from our notions of land, rock, and ownership. Can't ride a bottomless plain, colored trust in our sails, in the lax, placid matter that holds. Not from falls, for you too fill your head so your gossamer motors move onward, but holds your shape firm. Even you, if you never once moved, if you didn't take in the first place where you are, fold around that cold present, then push out with liquid momentum like knowledge from flushed chambered cells would ascend nowhere new. In the planktonic dark, a touch is the world, the devouring of touch, motion's guidance. Your emptied bell head tolls the thrust, the soul luminous effort, clear life, thinking's lost. I have a few bird poems in the book. I try not to do too many of those anymore. leave that to my husband, who's a poet and writes often of birds. But I ended up with a few in the book. And this one, actually a response to, in some ways, to Shelley's Ode to a Skylark, which is a famous romantic poem in which the poet talks about the profuse strains of unpremeditated art that he's admiring. I'm simplifying things here, but that he's admiring in the Skylark song. And I took a more scientific perspective of the bird and wanted to sort of write an homage to it along those lines. So this is called Anatomy of a Skylark. And there are a few terms that refer to particular kinds of bones that birds have, but I don't think you need to worry about those, so I'll just read the poem. Anatomy of a Skylark. Inside a bird, there are chambers and chambers, tunnels through scapular bones, tarsus, flues. Tongue under mandible, thin, flat, and tapered. Feathers in mantle, top, down-folded wing. Oxygen circulates, pale pair of lungs, paths to esophagus, gizzard and heart, thumbnail-sized, breast, of course, puffed up with plumage, quills, the original pinpointed art. Words follow from this. Do they say anything, mythic as music, while lizard feet, instruments grew in the hollow, where noises, genus of throat, found a pain's form. I'm going to read a land poem, sort of emerging out from the water, up into the air, and so on. And I have a few that actually on the land. So this is called Field. Is it a thing we build inside ourselves that gives us so much purpose? Maybe. But sometimes when I look out on a field as others did, have done, at chicory's angular slants of blue, bull thistle's bursts of purple fervor, Queen Anne's lace, and all the other pigments of expanse, tall weedy flourishes that nudged into black atmospheres, their leaf or sprout or semaphore, stemmed inch by green stemmed inch, and wove a length of knots and stoppages that filled the land's flat vacancy. My thought seeps back into itself, under a grid of soil and pale curved roots, as if the mind were just another naked field, the darkened mind. Leave that section and go into the final section of the book, in which there are poems dealing with more of the profane subject matter that I mentioned. They tend to be, there are a few more confessional poems, more emotional and erotic distress poems about those things. And I'm going to read just a couple of short poems from that section. Transformation is another theme in the book, and that is an abiding interest of mine. And that's obvious in this poem. This is called Geometry, and I think this poem was motivated by thinking about the ways in which we can change ourselves or try to change ourselves to suit other people or what we think they want from us. Geometry. I made myself a circle, then a square. I made a box too small for him to open, and then a portal which, from anywhere, displayed the magnitude of my affection. Once full of pliant roundnesses and curves, his private tapestry, I made a skin tight as a drum, impervious to pain, and drew this on as if to stop an army, then turned into a blossom on a plain, rose-like and fragrant, luring him to come and nestle in. I threw the flower at him, crumpled in a ball. It hit the floor, and there I was, plain, angry red, a sphere as foreign to his faculties as Mars. In every way I wanted him to care, I made myself a circle, then a square. Here's another sort of overly emotional poem that is confessional, I think, although it relies on metaphor to convey all of that distress. This poem is called Bell Tower. My throat is a bell tower in a stone cathedral, tolled and echoing. Great pangs of discord plumb the hollow calm there, where once woolen blue morning mist filled the arcs of the bell tower's walls, until gray doves awoke in the soft down of hope, of desire. Now the bells peal all wrong. If an ear could hear deep, muffled chords from a tangled up throat that feels like a bell tower wrung wild with fear by strong hands. But the bell's tone belongs to no town. Actually, I'm just going to read two more short poems and then I'll be done. There's a lot of bell and music imagery throughout. So this is another one. This is called Chimes. Leaves flutter wild in wind. Now, as day descends, he hears the old wind chimes. Moon like a portal shines through nearby trees again. Wind plays on the chimes. His neighbor's lights go on, gold from the window panes, a fence and garden dims. All matter must succumb, he thinks, as darkness climbs. Houses lose their lines. Still, the old wind chimes play in the air again, a tune without a mind. My last poem. I grew up with my mother, who is a musician. I was raised by her, and she's been playing various instruments since her 20s. She started with guitar and moved on to the banjo, and played that for a long time. And for the last 20 years or so, she's been playing the hammered dulcimer. But when I was a kid growing up, it was the banjo and bluegrass, and I was very familiar with musicians coming over and there being jam sessions and so on, and going to some festivals, bluegrass festivals. And one of the things that I loved to see going to hear that music was the way that musicians, and they'll do this with jazz and in other genres of music too, but the bluegrass musicians would, at some of these festivals, they'd be playing with and for each other, and they wouldn't be necessarily playing for an audience. They'd just get together and sort of be in a circle, looking at one another, playing the instrument, responding to these subtle indications from one another, and changes in tone and rhythm and so on. So that's something that's really stuck with me, that kind of improvisational playing together, not for an audience, but for one another. And this poem was inspired by looking at, actually, a cluster of trees that appeared to me to be like musicians that were playing in this way. And the poem is called Suggestive grove. These trees strike me as musicians, bent toward one another's notes. One leans to catch a strand of melody or the refrain strummed on a mandolin. One hunches vigilantly, displaying with clenched silence that he'll be joining soon. One to the left gestures to the rest to urge them on, claps his hands and nods in duple time. I see their creviced faces, how they mark, without a word, the supple indications intimate to them, or linger, poised, as if this were about attentiveness, instead of making noise. Maybe it is just an intense abstraction as they sway in unison or crane to hear new strains begin, to understand what has begun so they themselves might enter. Something like faith encompasses them all, something like faith or piety. They can't conceive of ending it. One's shift or surge of merging notes belongs to each of them, was part of all their thoughts about the notes before they played a song. To improvise is contemplation's voice. Thank you.